And today, oddly enough, we're going to study how Satan uses unselfishness. So Satan wants us to be unselfish. So we're going to talk about how that is. We're on 26. All right, somebody could start off and read the first paragraph for us. First off, did everybody get a handout? I've got a couple more up here if we run low. Okay, somebody could start off and read the first paragraph.
My dear Longwood, yes, courtship is the time for sowing those seeds which will grow up 10 years later into the nest of hatred. The enchantment of unsatisfied desire produces results, which the human can be made to mistake for the results of charity, love. Avail yourself of the ambiguity of the word love. Let them think they have solved by love problems they have, in fact, only waived or postponed under the influence of the enchantment. While at last, you have your chance to foment the problem and treat it, and render them fine.
Okay. This one launches right into the topic at hand. First sentence was very interesting. Courtship's the time for sowing those seeds which will grow up 10 years later in domestic hatred. Hopefully none of you have experienced that, but whenever you're dating, you have what's referred to in your early marriage is what's called the honeymoon period, when everybody is going out of their way to be nice to the other person, and you would never, ever dream of hurting the other person's feelings, and you're on your what we call our best behavior. So during that time, it says we're laying the groundwork for what might later be termed hatred. So what's going on here during that time, during that honeymoon period? Okay, you're not being yourself. Okay, why are you not being yourself?
You're pretending to do something you're not because you think this is what will please the other person.
Okay. Yes, Rick.
Allows kids to feel stronger during that period.
Okay. Some people may debate whether love itself is stronger, but certainly your emotional feeling is stronger during that time. And we want to make sure everybody understands, since this is a little more mature crowd than we have in some of the classes, that a lot of people confuse that idea of the emotional butterflies in the stomach with love, a long-term committed type of love. And so we don't want, and the confusion comes in that the English language uses the same word love to mean so many different things. Not like Greek, where you have a lot of different words that describe the different nuances of love. We use love for everything. And so it's easy to confuse that giddy feeling at the time whenever you first have an infatuation with somebody with the love that you may feel 20 or 30 or 50 years later for the person. And so in one sense, that giddy feeling and that infatuation level is very high, that emotional feeling, when you are so excited just to see that other person and you're so pleased that that person is responding back and they're paying attention to you and it appears that they like you as well. And that part is very strong at the beginning of that period. So what's the result that has on a relationship during that time? Yep. And sometimes whenever we see people argue, we say you're arguing like an old married couple. So, which is very different than a young married couple, that you might say. Okay. So what I'm trying to lead to is during that honeymoon period, when you're on your best behavior and you're overlooking all of the other person's faults, why is that laying the groundwork for hatred later on?
Later on, you're going to feel like a martyr.
Okay. That's the part we're going to lead to here, is that feeling of being a martyr. Right at first, you don't mind. You know, you're captivated by the differences of that person. They're very different than you, and that's very exciting because this person is very different than you are. Later on, those differences can become a problem depending on what they are.
We as human beings long want to get something new anyway. Mm-hmm. You get a new car and you're out there polishing all the time, and then you get that first parking lot thing and it kind of goes downhill from there. You get this new job and you love it at first because, you know, now I've got that first new job, or I've been on unemployment, now I've got a job, and then after you're there for a while, you kind of learn the people and it kind of leaves you disgusted. We do that. We go bored with things a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And then when the reality sits in is when you got to figure out that this is how it's going to be.
I remember when I started working in a plywood plant and was working 12-hour shifts at night in 90-degree temperature. And it was so exciting because I didn't have to work at the fiberglass place anymore, where I had fiberglass in my clothes all the time, and you could never get away from that itchy feeling. And those horrible conditions at the plywood plant were fantastic compared to what I was used to before. So I was so happy to be there. It was just like night and day, so to speak, except now I was working at night and I was in the daytime. But it was fantastic. But that honeymoon period wears off after a while. And it's the same with human relationships. So he says, avail yourself of the ambiguity of the word love. Let them think they've solved by love problems that they've in fact only waived or postponed under the influence of the enchantment. So what's happening there? What's he talking about?
Eros love dominates that relationship instead of an agape love. And the Eros will not last.
Okay.
It's a love that will not last. But we don't think so. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it dominates. But it won't last unless it's a mixture of those with the agape. It wears off, and then when that starts to wear off,
the visible sign of that was back in the old days, whenever cars had bench seats, when you were dating, the guy would drive and the girl would sit right beside him in the middle of the bench seat. Most of you are old enough to remember that, probably. As the relationship wears on, the woman moved farther and farther and farther to the right, you know, until the days of seat belts when you had to pick a spot there. And so, you know, eventually you move over into that rightmost spot, you know, and there you're buckled in again. Most cars today have bucket seats, and so you don't have that option anymore. But in the old bench seat days, you could tell how far a relationship had progressed by looking into the front seat of the car.
It's really hard to get that motorcycle.
Well, then you don't have a whole lot of seating options at that point. Okay, so it says, while it lasts, you have your chance to foment the problems in secret and render them chronic. So what kind of problems is he talking about here? That you have to work on during that honeymoon period if you're a demon. What are the issues that you overlook early in a relationship that become an irritant that are harder to overlook later on? Especially if you're two very different people.
Instead of lifting the dirty clothes hand for putting his clothes in, he laid it on top of it. Those are the little things you overlook.
If during the honeymoon, you go through and pick them up when you.
Yeah, but when you and you know the world is truth. You have all these other obligations, and once you get back into your regular life, that these little inconveniences that didn't bother you during the honeymoon phase now just add to all the other problems you got, and they cause problems.
Okay. especially when it comes to spending money. Oh, they're just so free with their money, you know. That's
because it's on me.
Oh, well, yeah, there's that. But then later on, you know, when you're married, and especially in couples where the woman takes over handling the finances, then if the husband still has those same free spending ways, it can lead to a lot of problems later on. And so all these things that you overlook during the honeymoon period become sources of irritation, and then later on to the point of being hatred, as Screwtape puts it, 10 years later. All right, somebody could read the second paragraph. Please. Glossary on the back. Okay, we're going to talk about here about how happy it is for Satan to use the idea of unselfishness, because we hear all the time we should be unselfish, and so Screwtape says you can use that idea of unselfishness, because it's very hard to be unselfish for a long time without beginning to feel resentment, especially if you feel like the other person is taking advantage of the fact that you're being unselfish. So. He says that Satan has tried to substitute the word unselfish for the word love. Tried to kind of make the two interchangeable, is what he was trying to say in that first line there. So whereas we're supposed to love each other and do things willingly for one another, Satan will substitute you should be unselfish. Which sounds good. It sounds like it's pretty much the same thing. But unselfishness, he says, comes at a price, because that implies that you're doing something, in a sense, a little bit grudgingly. Like, with the idea of love, you look at it as, I love this other person, and it doesn't bother me at all when I do something for them. Unselfishness carries the connotation of, I'm going to do this realizing I'm purposely being unfair to myself, but I'm going to choose to do it anyway because that's the Christian thing to do. So, there's a very fine line of difference between these two. But Satan finds a way to use all those fine lines of difference between things. So, he goes on to say that there's a difference between men and women. This was written 70 years ago, so I'd like for you to read it and decide if you think that this is still true today. He said that women try to be unselfish by doing things for other people. They're unselfish with their time. They're willing to go out and help other people and do things for them. Where it says men try to be unselfish by not getting involved in places where they're not supposed to get involved. They should stay out of other people's business whenever they feel like they shouldn't get involved and that it would be wrong for them to get involved in somebody else's business. Do you see Do you think that that was accurate then and or accurate now? Do you think that is a difference in personality, or do you think C.S. Lewis was wrong? Now, you always get into dangerous territory when you try to make generalizations about differences in gender. But there are some aspects that we associate with men and women, and legitimately so, even if they're not true 100% of the time, they're generally true with a large percentage of the population. So that's what I'm trying to determine here. Do you think that he's on target with that, or do you think that he missed the boat? Okay. When somebody's sick, women are always the ones that get together and say, let's take them food, right? Okay. All right. So, that much definitely seems to be on target. And that's a good thing. Don't get me wrong. That's a fantastic thing. But we'll talk about how Satan uses it in a minute.
Something comes along and says, hey, this goal is no longer achieved, men have no reason to go back and keep working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a major difference that I think, you know, is similar to what he's saying here. I don't know that it's necessarily always as selfish or unselfish. It's just that way that we tend to go through life doing things.
Right.
I think that his perspective on this accurate, it comes out that way, that men pretty well just leave people alone. It's not my business. It's not, you know, something I need to be involved in. I'm going to leave them alone, and that's what people want anyway. Mm-hmm. Where women are going, it is my business because people need help, and I'm going to do it. That's just the way a lot of folks are.
A woman sees somebody upset, and she wants to know why, and let them talk it out, and the guy leaves them alone. How many sitcom plots have been based around the wife wants to fix the couple up? Oh, I see this nice couple. They should be together. I'll fix them up. And husband says, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the way we do things. We like to see people happy or content or whatever.
Yeah. If a guy sees another guy is unhappy, he's far more likely to say, let's go fishing or let's go bowling or something, rather than let's sit down and talk about the problem and try to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just get your mind off of it. Because it's none of my business. I don't want to hear your personal business. So I'll just go out and try to cheer you up. Okay. So it's very different. But what C.S. Lewis writes here is that each sex, without any obvious unreason, can and does regard the other as radically selfish. Okay. So if you're looking at things from two different ways, whether you're a man or a woman, how are you going to view that other person as being selfish?
From a man's viewpoint, as he sees the woman or his wife doing all these unselfish things for other people, then he starts and says, well, I'm not getting any of these for myself, you know.
Okay.
And so therefore, she's being selfish by not giving all this attention to me, but she's depending on all this other attention. By the same token, the woman then looks at her husband and says, he's not doing what I'm doing. So he's becoming very selfish.
Don't eat that cake, I make it for
somebody
else. Right. Yeah. You can see how some resentment could begin to build up from the two sides, where both think they're being unselfish and both see the other as being selfish because they're doing things differently than they would have. And this permeates all different types of relationships, especially marriage relationships, where both sides, if you hear their side of the story, the other person is completely in the wrong. And they're completely blameless. All this stuff just happened. They just do this. And they're oblivious to it. They don't even realize what a jerk they're being. on the other side. And of course, I didn't do anything wrong because I did this and this and this. And so you see that each person thinks, I've been completely unselfish in all this. And the other person is just being completely selfish.
That's why I thought they didn't let you
know. I thought so. I knew there must have been some good reason.
I mean, if you didn't think you were being a jerk, it's not because I didn't let you know. That's all I can say.
I cannot argue with that at all. Yeah. Holding things in has never been a problem.
We'll be talking to you later.
But we'll have that conversation later. How are you for two? That should give us enough time. All right, paragraph two. The one numbered two.
On top of these confusions, it cannot live these two more. The erotic enchantment produces a mutual complacence in which each is really pleased to feed into the wishes of the other. They also know that the enemy demands of them a degree of charity which is attained, would result in similar actions. You must make them establish as a law for their whole married life that degree of mutual self-sacrifice, which is at present sprouting naturally out of the enchantment, but which, when the enchantment dies away, they will not have charity enough to enable them to perform. They will not see the trap since they are under the double blindness of mistaken sexual excitement for charity and of thinking that the excitement will last. When once a sort of official legal or nominal unselfishness has been established as a rule for the keeping of which their emotional resources have died away and their spiritual resources have not yet grown, the most delightful result follows. In discussing any joint action, it becomes obligatory that A should argue in favor of B's supposed wishes and against his own, while B does the opposite. It is often impossible to find out either party's real wishes, with luck that ends by doing something that neither wants. While each feels a glow of self-righteousness and harbors a secret flame through it, preferential treatment of the unselfishness shown and a secret grudge against the other for the ease with which the sacrifice has been accepted.
Okay, place where you see this. We're going to go out. Where would you like to eat? I don't care. Where would you like to eat? I don't care. Okay, well, you know, I was kind of thinking of here, and the other person was kind of thinking of here. Okay, well, we'll do what you want. Oh, no, we don't have to. Let's do what you want. Well, okay, well, then, you know, let's just go to this other place that neither of us wanted. Okay, so that's where we're going to end up eating, even though neither of us really wanted to eat there. That way, neither of us had to feel selfish by going to the place where we wanted to eat. So, now then, both parties feel resentment. And neither party got what they wanted. Okay? So that's a trivial example. How does it work in the marriage relationship when this becomes the way that we resolve issues? It's easy whenever you're talking about going out to eat. What about when we hit other stickier subjects that are perhaps a little bit more meaningful and that we might remember a little bit longer?
Well, I think that, you know, he indicates here, you know, there's a difference in how we typically interact in what we refer to as honeymoon phase of marriage, where we are trying to be unselfish and we give, and then we're just so much in love that everything the other person does is like, you know, it's as you wish, whatever, you know, and I'll gladly, you know, do whatever you want. I want you to be happy, but then we get that reality.
it's, you know, using the going out to eat example, you know, during the dating phase, you know, the girl goes to what I like to call the chick restaurants, the one where, you know, you get a leaf and a twig on your plate or something, you know, and there's no real food on the menu. And so, you know, right at first, oh, well, this is different. You know, I've never eaten at this kind of place before. But after a while, you know, then the guy starts like, you know, I'd really like to have a steak. You know, there's no steak on this vegetarian menu of this frou-frou place that she always wants to go to. And so if you continue to be unselfish, because you're told you should be unselfish, so you keep giving in, but the resentment builds deeper and deeper because you gave in each time. That's where the problems begin to develop and the crevices in the relationship begin. And it all starts during the honeymoon period, whenever you legitimately don't care. And then after a while you do care, but you're in love, so you're going to go along with it. And then a little bit later on, okay, well, now that I'm grudgingly going along with it because I'm supposed to be unselfish, Russ told me I was supposed to be, so I'm going to be. And I'm not going to say anything until that day whenever everything explodes. And so, you know, after a while, all those pent-up feelings start rushing out of all the ways that I've been unselfish and you've been selfish. And this happens on both sides. And next thing you know, you're in a knock-down, drag-out argument over something that started out very trivial. But now then, after 10 years, I've been saving all this stuff up, and it all comes out in a flood and blindsides the other person that thought all this time we liked the same things. But no, you were just being unselfish the whole time. Okay. Thoughts are coming. Goes back to the first sentence of this page.
Absolutely.
Up here at
but
the top.
To see it in action and to see it with somebody who's a very smart, level-headed, intelligent person, to see how they can be blindsided by this infatuation, but as a friend and a Christian, you have to be subtle. You don't want it, because I know she might be offended, but to be talking, just a little part of the bond. I mean, this person.
Say love is blind for a reason, because sometimes it's so obvious to everybody else that this person is making a mistake.
I think a lot of times it's not that when, especially when you're dating in the honeymoon thing, not that you don't see the bad part, but a lot of times, and I think it happens on the man and the woman side both, thinking, you know, if he's with me long enough or if she's with me long enough, they will change. Mm-hmm. And this is not the case. I used to tell my kids this all the time. Before you get married, you look at that person and you look at all the things you like about them and things you don't like about them. Then you ask yourself, can I live with these negative parts for 20, 30, 40, or even 50 years? Because you're not going to change that person. Now, they may be at their best behavior right now, but all of these traits that you've already seen, they're not going to go away. They're still going to be there.
Mm-hmm. A woman gets married hoping the man will change, and the man gets married hoping the woman won't. And both are going to be disappointed.
And you bring up a good point. You talk about when you look at all these negative aspects, because you're going to get even more than this.
Yeah.
That's why I try to tell my kids, this is as good as it gets right here. There's something you can't live without here.
That's true. And it's hard for some people to believe. And they may respond with, like your friend Tammy, of it's easy for you. You've already found a good person. You know, this is the only person I've found. And so sometimes at a point in your life, you feel like maybe it's this person or nobody. And so then that becomes a very tough decision. Is this person better than nobody? Sometimes they're not. Sometimes you're better off with nobody, but it's really hard to see that. And especially whenever you're still in that process of overlooking faults.
Because it's so obvious you overlook your faults. Like, whoa. Open your eyes. No.
I know. And it's very frustrating. Because women want to get involved and the men say stay out of it.
Jack is probably telling you to leave alone.
But you know later on she's going to say, why didn't you warn me? That's right. There's an opening for three, you know. So, okay, somebody could read paragraph three.
Later on, you can get your own way. Maybe call the children's conflict. This game is played, best played, but more than two players. And his family was growing up children, like them, something white children, like Alan T. and John, the folks. One number take care to make it quite clear. Not there's so many words that you can learn about. But he is, of course, prepared to be so out of unsettled. The others just with God was clear before. Ostensibly, he was there unsettled, but really because they don't want to be used as a sort of labor figure on this first. He insists on doing what the others want. They insist on doing what he wants. Passions are routes. Soon someone is saying, very well then, I won't have any teeth at all in a year or four, including the bitter resentment on both sides. You see how it is done? That each side has been frankly contending for its own dear wit. They would all have kept within the bounds of reason. Courtesy, but just because the contention is reversed from each side of the fight, the other side out. All the goodness which really follows from for self righteousness and optimism and the accumulated pleasures of the last 10 years are still condemned by the nominal or official perception of what they are doing, or at least failed to be excused by it. Each side is indeed quite alive to the chief quality of the adversary, unsettledness, and of the false position in which he is trying to force them. But each managed to feel blameless and feel he himself with no more responses than come back to him.
Okay. So what he's saying with all those words is that this gets even more fun for the demons whenever you're in a big group. And the whole group is trying to decide what to do. And so in the whole group, everybody has their own opinion of what they want to do. And this, he says, if everybody just simply argued for their own opinion, it would be settled pretty easily because you're not going to defend your position there too vigorously. But in that situation, everybody wants to be unselfish. And so everybody is more than willing to give in to the other person, and they start arguing for the other person. And so You may not be willing to defend your own position that well, but you'll defend to the death the other person's right to get what they want. And so they said it's a lot of fun to sit back and start that argument and then watch it ensue, where everybody is trying to be unselfish, and so everybody is trying to give everybody else what they want. And finally, everybody goes home mad, and nobody got what they wanted during that time.
Well, what he's talking about here, too, is like, okay, I'm going to prove I'm more unselfish than you are.
Exactly. It becomes a contest.
Altruism. I'm going to prove I'm better by giving up what I want. You know, and yeah, if you end up with bending over backwards and tying yourself in knots, trying to convince the other person to do it their way.
That's right, because I'm the least competitive one here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, and I'm going to prove.
Yes. Yes, in fact, whenever I was reading this, that's what I thought about. We were visiting my grandmother one time, and she was talking about she has a granddaughter that she raised as her daughter whenever the parents were killed in an accident. And Connie doesn't come around much anymore, and she doesn't call, but that's all right. And you could tell exactly the sentiment that was coming through with that she was being unselfish. And she wasn't going to say anything.
And Connie probably just called that morning.
Probably had, you know, but it's never often enough. So.
I was also thinking of standing in line behind the people at Captain D's.
Oh, yes, yes. We were in line one time at Captain D's, and it was this group of older people, and the lady says, well, what do you want to eat? I don't know. What do you want to eat? What does your mama want? I don't know. What does your mama want? Well, I was going to pay. Oh, no, that's all right. I'm going to pay. And we're back there thinking, look, we'll pay for everybody. Just decide and go order something.
With one stomach.
But they were all determined to be completely unselfish, and it was taking forever for them to make any decisions because of it.
And you were going to be unselfish by paying for it.
Exactly, but grudgingly. You know, I wasn't going to be happy about it, but it was going to get them out of the way. But now you see the way the game is played. And Satan has a lot of fun with this game with us because we're being Christians and we're being unselfish. Yes.
Yeah, you know, the point that he makes here also is very significant. He mentions something that's very simple, very petty, as a, you know, having feet in the garden, and that's typically what happens. It's not usually the big issues, you know, that go on in our lives that we get into problems with. It's oftentimes the little thing. And that little thing in and of itself is really nothing, but when you, as he talks about, you bring in 10 years of little things, that's a big thing.
And it sets the pattern for the big things. So, yeah, I'm always going to give in, and I'm going to be the martyr in this situation. So no matter whether it's a big thing or a little thing.
Again, when you give in and decide you're not going to give in anymore, the government says, well, what is going on with
us? Yeah. Shocking.
It didn't work this time.
That's right.
Don't we do this when we start to think of the weaker Christian? The other person's always the weaker Christian when there's an argument. I'm going to get into the weaker Christian. I'm going to be the bigger one there.
That's right.
But it's never that we might be the weaker Christian. They are.
But you know, put yourself in the situation. You want to do one particular thing, and three other people in the group want to do something else, and they all give in to what you want. So then, now then, that leaves you feeling terrible. Well, I got what I wanted, but nobody else got what they wanted. And you don't ever want to be in that situation, especially if what you wanted to do doesn't turn out too well. And then they're all blaming you. You're the one that wanted to go here. You know, this is all your fault, and nobody wants to be in that situation. Okay, if somebody could read the last paragraph, we'll finish up.
A sensible human once said, if people knew how much ill-feeling unselfishness occasions, it would not be so often recommended from the pulpit. And again, she's the sort of woman who lives for others. You can always tell the others by their hunted expression. All this came can be begun even in the period of courtship. A little real selfishness in the patient's part is often of less value in the long run for securing the soul than the first beginning of that elaborate and self-consciousness, unselfishness, which may one day blossom into the sort of thing I have described. Some degree of mutual falseness, some surprise that the girl does not always notice just how unselfish he is being, can be smuggled in already. Cherish these things. Above all, don't let the young fools notice them. If they notice them, they will be on the road to discovering that love is not enough, that charity is needed, and not yet achieved, and that no external law can supply its place. I wish some trumpet would do something about undermining that young woman's sense of the ridiculous. Your affectionate uncle, Okay.
Okay. What do you think about that first line? If people knew how much ill feeling unselfishness occasions, it would not be so often recommended from the pulpit. we all think unselfishness is a great thing. And in its pure form, it can be. But there's rarely such a thing as a pure form of unselfishness in our lives. It's a rare person that can be completely unselfish without harboring that slight little bit of resentment, especially if they feel like they're the one being unselfish all the time. Because it just takes a little bit of time before they switch from unselfishness to now I'm being taken advantage of. And as you've seen in this handout, both parties can feel that way on a regular basis if Satan is doing his job. He can arrange it so that both of you feel like you're being unselfish, and yet you still feel taken advantage of.
I guess there's the difference between being truly unselfish and just giving in.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about Jesus, and Jesus was just very humble and did a lot of things, but he also wasn't a doormat. Mm-hmm. When there was something wrong, he stood up and said something about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that a better term to use would be self-sacrifice as opposed to unselfishness.
Mm-hmm.
Because, if I'm in a group of five people and four of them want to go somewhere to eat, and that wouldn't be where I would choose, I would go because not everything is a cause for an argument. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't go there and then grumble about it the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You go there and there's going to be something on the menu you can eat. We're so picky nowadays, but there's going to be something there you can eat. So, you just do it and go on with it. I might would say, hey, how about this? But everybody else says, no, I want to go here. That's okay. I'm okay with that. But we tend to not do that. It's like, I gave up what I wanted to do and do that. Or just go by yourself if that's your issue. It's,
Yes.
But we like to be able, it's like we get a check mark for having done mm-hmm. it. I gave in to them, so I get my little check mark today. That was my charitable contribution day. I didn't argue over that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And sometimes in a marriage, a decision has to be made. And it's got to go one way or the other. You grew up in this denomination and I grew up in this. We can't go to both every week. And how are we going to raise the children? That's where things really get sticky, is what are we going to teach our children when you and I have two different ideas about something? Let the children decide. Yeah, that works out well.
It's all the more critical that you've got to achieve that agape love.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot stay in that in this first stage and stay married. You just won't. It's got to go over to the agape.
Well, that's the big question that you come after all this. Okay, what's my alternative to unselfishness? And the answer is actual self-sacrificing love, where you legitimately don't mind whenever things don't always go your way. And that's very difficult to achieve, especially if both of the members of the party don't buy into it.
Oftentimes, unselfishness has my best interest.
Exactly.
I don't want the conflict or whatever the case may be. But we give in because we're unselfish, and that may not be what's best for
selfishness has as its root selfishness in many cases.
Like I think of a parent-child relationship. It might seem really unselfish to give your child everything they want. You know, I may not get something I need, but I'm going to make sure the kids get the latest video game or whatever. And that, you know, we might consider that unselfish, but it's not really, because we're wanting that, we're trying to buy their love. There's a self-serving interest there. When they may be better served by saying, no, if there's something you want, you need to work and save up for it, or no, I don't think you need that, that's not the best thing for you.
That's exactly right. It's the agape love, where we legitimately want the best for the other person, is the goal, not mere a statement of unselfishness as defined in I'm going to give up what I want or even what I think is best simply so that I have this personal feeling of self-satisfaction that I gave in because I was unselfish. Okay. Any last closing comments?
Yeah, I'm just going to say it's unselfishness. You know, Scripture tells us in several places that Christ took time to go out, you know, to be with God, you know, by himself. You know, he didn't say, okay, you know, I'm going to be unselfish and spend all day, every day, you know, preaching to the multitudes or even with his chosen. You know, he took time to go out and recharge himself. And, you know, I believe there's at least one occasion where the apostles were looking for him to find him. You know, and they were a bit puzzled, you know, where'd you go? You know, it's easy for us, or maybe for them, but so we're going to be extremely selfish, you know, going off by himself, you know, not telling us where he went. So, you know, yeah, you do have to have a drop of self-interest in order to keep yourself going. And I think this, you know, ties in with what we're saying. You know, it's too easy to slip into false martyrdom. You know, okay, well, I'll just give them all the time to everything, and then I can wear my little martyr badge, you know, on my lapel, you know, and everybody will think I'm something.
Yeah. All right. Wes, could you close us in prayer?
Oh, Lord, I come before you every time. I thank you so much for your time that have allowed us to study this topic this morning, and we thank you, Lord, for giving us this gift. Lord, we pray that we have the prayer to be able to live the church we can use it for our best country, to try to show our pleasure to you and try to deliver your message to those who do not know you. Help us, Lord, to keep it to the heavens, to that mission will be, and do the best to drive the rest of the world.